All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers? What the fuck nicks? What the fuck nuts? What the fuck sticks? What's happening? I'm Mark Maron. This is my podcast. Welcome to it. How you doing? Are you okay? First of all, Stephen Root is on the show today. Stephen Root, the amazing character actor who you've seen in a million things. Too many, all the Coen Brothers movies, Office Space. He's on Barry this season. And he's a fucking genius, and he came by to talk. That's happening. On another note, go to sortoftrust.com to find out where the movie is playing near you. It's still in a lot of theaters and on demand. That's the movie I did with Lynn Shelton, Michaela Watkins, Jillian Bell, John Bass, Toby Huss, Michaela Watkins. Did I say that already? See, I don't know. Look, I don't know if I'm getting Zen or I'm getting dementia. I don't know. I do not know. Oh my God. I just got back from New York. It was a long flight. I didn't sleep much. I was there doing press and eating things I shouldn't. That was on the agenda. I had a schedule. It said do Colbert. It said, do AOL Build. It said, you're going to do some serious radio show and then you're going to do a SAG panel with Betty and Allison, and you're also going to eat cheese, which you don't usually do, and don't be afraid to go ahead and stuff your face because you're away from home. And yeah, you brought your running shoes and your shorts and your running shirt, but don't bother going because it's sad in a hotel gym, isn't it? But maybe if you went to a joined Equinox. No, you can't. See, maybe if you yeah, that's where that was at. So that happened. I'm okay. I'm all right. How you doing? You okay? Everybody good? Also, tour dates, please, Texas. I'll be in Dallas, Austin, and Houston, Texas next week, August 22nd through 24th. You can go to WTFpod.com/tour for my tour dates upcoming. Yeah, get tickets to the shows if you want to see me. That hour 15, hour and a half is coming along nicely. It's bold. It's fresh. It's crass. It's elevated, and it's relieving. I will say that. I was in New York and spent time with Betty and Allison. We had a very nice time. I did a panel, Screen Actors Guild panel, where they showed a couple of episodes of the show. And then, we do a little Q&A. And I don't really know how to advise, but I did have some advice, and I'll share that with you in a minute. But I did want to clear some stuff up. On Monday, I talked about the passing of the amazing David Berman of Silver Jews and poetry fame. I also, when I was in New York, I had a nice kind of hour and a half reflection about David with Matt Sweeney, the guitar player who was much closer to him than I was. Like I said on Monday, I didn't really know him that well, but I was always sort of obsessed with him and his work. And Matt kind of fleshed things out for me a little bit, told me where David was at over the last couple years of his life, and that was interesting. We had a moment of reflection about other people we've known who have died or ended their lives. As you get older, these things happen. It's sad. But the one thing I did want to clear up, because I didn't know for sure, but now I know for sure. The poem I read, the reflections I had about him, were all on the money for me, and they come from my heart. But the poem I read that I attributed to David Berman apparently is not the right David Berman. And I want to straighten that out, because one thing I've come to know over the years is that when you pass away, when your time is done here on this planet, or the alive part, it's sort of astounding how quickly that news and that tragedy or that passing, however it's experienced, kind of fades into the past. And I think everybody wonders how they're going to be remembered, if they're going to be remembered, what happens in a practical sense after you pass away. I try not to think about it. I imagine most of us try not to think about it. But one thing that I would want to hope doesn't happen is that if I have some work out there that is ambiguous in terms of it being confused with someone else's work or mislabeled as someone else's work or not separated and it's put out into the world as yours, that would be That would be a bummer. If I was dead and that happened to me, that would bum me out. So a couple of people emailed me, and apparently there was a blog post by the David Berman that passed away a week or so ago from the Silver Jews, from Purple Mountains, from poetry. And it was dated May 29th, 2009. This was a blog post by the late David Berman, who I talked about. And it just says, FYI colon other David Bermans. David Berman, the plastic surgeon who reattached John Bobbitt's penis. David Berman, mobster and co-owner of the Flamingo Hotel with Bugsy Siegel. David Berman, graphic designer, author of Do Good Design, a book on ethical standards for graphic designers. David Berman, the theoretical physicist. David Berman, television actor, CSI. David Berman, the Irish philosopher. David Berman, 1934 to 2017, was an attorney, an accomplished poet who's very different from my own poetry, is nevertheless often accredited to me. Three of his poems, and here is his book. All these are links to the things I'm reading off. At this site, the first 9 poems are by him, the next 5 by me. Far be it from me to stand in the way of another David Berman. And then there's David Berman with an H, the electronic music pioneer and minimalist composer. Here is his record, Unforeseen Events. Now, the site that he's referring to is a site where I went, because I couldn't find the book, his book, right away, because it's in a pile with a thousand books downstairs, which are, you know, in the middle of transition, waiting to be reconfigured on shelves when I get the new studio up and running. But the poem, it's poemhunter.com, that has both David Berman's poetry lumped together. So to honor the David Berman, who I kind of knew and appreciated his work and know a lot of his work, I needed to make sure my heart was straight, read one of his actual poems. Now, I think the sentiment of the poem I read on Monday fits some of the things that David Berman, the guy I know, thinks about, but it was not his poem. And there was no reason to freak out. Many people made this mistake in remembering and blogging about Silver Jews, David Berman, Purple Mountains, David Berman. So this is a corrective. I'm trying to help this culturally. There's a cultural corrective, and you heard it from that blog post I read from David Berman, the guy who passed away a couple weeks ago. And this is a poem by that David Berman, the guy I was eulogizing and remembering on Monday. This is called Snow. Walking through a field with my little brother Seth, I pointed to a place where kids had made angels in the snow. For some reason, I told him that a troop of angels had been shot and dissolved when they hit the ground. He asked who had shot them, and I said, a farmer. Then we were on the roof of the lake. The ice looked like a photograph of water. Why, he asked, why did he shoot them? I didn't know where I was going with this. They were on his property, I said. When it's snowing, the outdoors seem like a room. Today, I traded hellos with my neighbor. Our voices hung close in the new acoustics, a room with the walls blasted to shreds and falling. We returned to our shoveling, working side by side in silence. But why were they on his property? He asked. That is a poem by the late David Berman, who I talked about on Monday. And I'm glad, I feel better now. I hope he does too, if there is that possibility that I wasn't one of the ones that misrepresented his poetry. Okay? All right? Okay. Folks, listen to me. Seriously, having grown up in a house. Hi, Buster. Come here. Just let me finish this. What are you doing? Huh? What? All right, just can I finish doing this? Let me just finish this. What? Okay. Hey, okay. I grew up in a house with mental illness, and I need, please try to take care of yourself for everybody's sake, please. And if you need help, get help. Please get help. There's help. Subject line, Finding Beauty in Darkness. Hey, Mark, I've listened since the beginning, and I've struggled with depression and alcoholism for a long time, too. Your show has helped me through many times I didn't know if I would make it through. I was never a big fan of Silver Jews, just didn't connect at the time, but listening to your eulogy for David Berman, I went and listened to the new record of Purple Mountains. I was probably on death's door with two young kids at 40. I immediately locked in with the beautiful darkness. Thank you. It's perhaps oddly the thing I needed to make my way past my troubles, or at least to reach out to those who care about me. Nothing profound. Just want to thank you. I'm still alive, and my kids have their father. Thanks. Nathan. Please get more help than a record. Okay? Please. Oh, my God. I'm just concerned, man. I'm just kidding. The mind is a fucking, who knows what's going on up there? But if it's like misfiring and you know, things are bleak and dark and they're happening inside your head, not outside, you know, try to get some help. So look, I don't know if I've told this story. I probably have. And I don't know. It's not really my place to help anybody. In a conscious way, like, you know, here's some advice. Buster, stop it. Buster, what are you doing? What is that noise? Hey, what? What are you doing? Just hang out a minute. I'm working here. All right, so... fucking cats, man. So I do this panel, and it's actor specific, and you've heard me here learning how to act from people I talk to and doing, yeah, whatever. I'm glad everyone likes Glow. I'm very proud of it. I'm proud of all the work I've done lately. But, you know, my training is limited, but I've had a lot of experience over the years with almost acting and things. And the question was really if the three of us had any advice for the audition process. Now, Allison and Betty have done this a lot more than me. They've been on a lot of auditions. They get very, you know, sort of productive sort of ways of framing the audition process and what you're really in and how it works. And, you know, the feeling of auditioning for the same people over and over again, like casting agents, and then sort of like making the most of the audition process, because that might be the only time you get to act that particular role. And then, like, I felt like I needed to say something, and I gave some advice that I gave to Conan, like a million years ago, like after, like he was in maybe his first year of the show, and I told him my current mantra at the time, which was hide the hate, and I told that to the actors. I said, "Well, when you go into that room, you got to hide the hate. Got a big laugh. I think it's practical." I'm not saying that people are hateful. I'm just saying that, you know, when you're being judged and you're insecure and you're scared, why not resent with malice? Maybe not with malice, or at least resent the people that have complete control of your future in that moment. How can you not? Maybe that's my problem. But I also shared this story, and I must have shared it at some point. Early on in my career, you know, when I was just an angry comic that, you know, really... yeah, people didn't really know me, but you know, I think I'd done a little TV, but I was intense and kind of shocking and jarring, and you know, not really defined, but people thought they could get a handle on me, like agents and managers thought, well, he's the cranky guy. No, I was really kind of unbridled, unformed, without boundary, and furious. I don't know why. Oh, I do know why, but it doesn't matter. It was a lot of things. I'm older now. I can't even remember how long ago this was. I must have been in my early 20s, maybe mid-20s. Somehow or another, there was a show casting, and it was like a behind-the-scenes. The show was to take place almost in a Larry Sanders kind of way, behind the scenes at a music video network. And I played a director or producer, my part was. So somehow or another, I'd made it to the network callback, which is really the last stop before you get the gig. And it was heavy duty. It was at the network. You know, usually with those things, you go in for people from the network. You go in for casting people. But it's mostly producers, the writers. Like, it's a big deal. It's like, it's the last stop before you're like, you got the gig. I saw some actors I recognized there. And I don't know, man. You know, I would freak out about fucking everything. This is what I realized in New York and what I'm realizing in my life and realizing with performing and just my job in general is I'm not that freaked out. You know, to go on Colbert, to go on those shows, I used to make myself crazy. I mean, I'm going over to Corden today, and I don't even know what I'm wearing. I'm not sure what I'm going to talk about, and I don't give a fuck because it's going to be fine. They'll tell me when I get there. But that took 30 years. Well, anyway, so this character, this monologue I got to do is like this guy losing his shit, basically, at another person. And I don't know where I was at, but I know that, you know, I had no control over my talent. I had no parameters. I didn't understand what it was. And same with my emotions. And also, you know, the same with my substances. So I'm about to go in for this reading of this monologue, and the casting agent comes up to me. And she's like, when you go in there, you know, just... you know, just go for it. You know, this guy's angry. He's raging. You can just go for it. And for some reason, I thought she said, go unload the entire anger of your entire life in that room inappropriately, without even remembering the lines of the character in front of a bunch of executives. That's what my brain heard. Go in there without any sense of character, any sense of what the scene is, and do this monologue with all the rage that is accumulated in your heart, mind, and spirit over the last, I guess, 20 some odd years of your life at that point. And I went in there, and she walked me in and sat down, and I unloaded. Like a type of rage, like I was spitting. I didn't know the lines. I wasn't talking to anyone in particular. I was just ranting and my red faced, just screaming all of my guts out, totally inappropriately for the character or anything, any public space, in general, anywhere, that type of expression. And I finished it and I took a breath and I looked at all of the executives and casting people that were sitting there, and they looked horrified, shocked, and maybe a little frightened. It was like, what just happened? And I'd like to say that they had me removed by security, but I think I just moped off. And I'm not even sure I felt like I had overdone it. I probably left thinking, yeah, you know, they wanted it, man. They wanted anger. They got it. So I did not get the part. And I think the general advice there was, you know, in a work situation or when you're interviewing, you know, kind of try to keep your pain and sadness and anger and hostility in check. You're there for a reason. Try to contextualize that. Don't use it as an opportunity to dump your entire life's worth of bile onto strangers that are in charge of giving you a job. I think that's reasonably good advice. So, look, people, I've told you what I need to tell you. Stephen Root, you will know this guy. Well, he's in Barry right now. He plays Bill Hader's kind of like contractor, his boss, partner, whatever, the Satan character. And he's up for an outstanding supporting actor in a comedy series for an Emmy for Barry. But, you know, he's been in, you know, it's a very memorable role. Do you remember Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? He was the blind radio station owner. He was also in Buster Scruggs. He was also the staple guy in Office Space. He's one of those reoccurring character actors that you're like, there's that guy, but he's fucking inspired, and I was happy to talk to him. This is me talking to Stephen Root. Yeah, I mean, you can move the mic. It kind of bounces around.
So you got to go close with it?
Here, where are you? How come I don't hear you?
I don't know.
Yeah.
It all started in the 5,000 Rod Radio
Station. Did it?
No.
It did not.
It did not start.
Well, you know, I appreciate you coming. I actually met you briefly, very briefly. I did one day of shooting on the Wedding Dates.
The Mike movie? Yeah.
And there it was at night there where everyone was staying, and it was like, hey, how are you? And that was it.
Yeah.
Do you watch the movies?
I watch them once.
I mean, it must get to a certain point when you've done a million movies.
Yeah.
Who was I talking to? Stephen Dorff. I guess it's kind of an awkward way to start, but
he must have done 200 movies. I mean, that guy's in everything.
Well, it was interesting. He was, and now, like, he did that True Detective thing, and I thought he really killed it. Yeah. Like, he really did something amazing to the point where I didn't even know who the fuck it was. It was like seeing somebody for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
But, he told me something I should have realized, but I didn't really realize, is that, like, sometimes as an actor, you take the gig, you know it's not going to be great, but you can do what you do, and that's that.
You do, and there's sometimes when you have a hole in your schedule,
right.
and you're not going to do Lear, you're just going to do something.
Yeah, and you just throw it in there.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I imagine after a certain point, you probably, it must be, I don't watch the shit I do.
Yeah. You don't have time, really.
Yeah.
I mean, because since I'm anciently old, it takes me most of my time just to memorize the shit I have to do.
Yeah.
You know, so no, I don't.
How old are you?
I was 68 in November.
And this is a big year, man.
It's a big year. It's a very cool year.
I mean, it's not like, you certainly deserve the attention.
Well, thank you. Good night.
I mean, Jesus, man. I mean, like, Barry's great. I love the fucking show. The character's great.
You know, it's a show that I liken in tone and intelligentsia to news radio. I feel like I did that, and now I'm doing this. Because it's really the first one I've really signed on to as a regular, because I didn't really want to until now.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because the writing is so good. Bill is unbelievable.
Yeah.
And the people who do it.
And the tone, the tone is just... That edge it rides between...
It walks right on the line.
You're just a hair away from hating these fuckers.
Yeah.
Like, they're just morally reprehensible, but you're kind of rooting for all of them.
Kind of like them. Then you get... They step over, and then they step back.
Like, wait a minute. Can I still like this guy and be a decent person? Person?
Is Sarah's character just a dick? No, she's really a good person.
Well, that one's easier to like because you know her, right? If you work in show
business.
She's
just self-involved, but she is good.
Right, it's her selfishness. But you and Hader,
her character,
those characters are just, shamelessly evil. but they don't really see it that way.
No, I don't. I think my character doesn't see it that way. Bill's character, I think, is really struggling PTSD. Mm-hmm. You know, that's what it is.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, I think.
I mean, that makes sense.
Yeah.
So what do you do to pull it together? Like, because this role, in terms of, like, the character work you've done, I guess we'll start with the new stuff. I rarely start with it, but I like the show.
Thanks.
But, like, this, in compared to some of the broader characters you've had to do, this guy is, pretty straight ahead, right? He's not, you don't have to manufacture too much physicality or that
kind
of stuff.
No, what's nice is he's a big character, but he's small.
Right.
You know, you see the small things in his face, and that's fun for me to play as a character
actor,
instead of, Buster Scruggs, where you're going, so it's fun to be small on this show.
But is it, now when you approach the script, because he is sort of a satanic character,
I describe him as a bad uncle.
But there seems to be this weight to his... his charm, and kind of keep pulling him over to the bad side.
Yeah, but it's all self-involved bullshit. Just
right.
Give me the money.
Yeah.
The end.
Yeah. And is that where you start when you try to put together a guy like that?
What was interesting about this show was that he didn't start to be that. He was very much of a one-note yeller, go out on this job guy.
Really?
In the pilot, yeah. And it was still an interesting character. We finished the pilot, yeah. We looked at it, and HBO looked at it, and they said, yeah, that's good. Where are you going to go now? Mm. You're already at 10. Where is he going to go?
Right.
And Bill and Alex said, yeah, you're right. And so they rewrote the character into the bad uncle that you see now.
Really?
So we reshot my portion of the pilot while we were shooting episode one.
No kidding.
Mm-hmm.
So it was just the guy was just a rager,
a straight out asshole rager. Yeah, which had nowhere to go. Much more interesting being the guy that had known his father for a long time.
Right.
He was a bad uncle and said, "How can I make money on this fucker?"
Yeah,
and
he's got this.
He
skill
figured
set.
That out.
Yeah,
I'll make him do this.
And also, and then without the yelling, all the charm and the sort of self pity, the kind of like weird, kind of like, "Come on,
yeah, come on,
what am I going
to
do?
This is why these are bad people? You want to kill them?"
But so then the work becomes, is it natural for you? Do you read the script 1,000 times?
I do because I like to have a solid base. But then, of course, immediately when you step on the set, Bill will go, "Nah, we don't need that." Throw that all away. You know, what do you think you'd say here? Well, I'd probably say this. Okay. You know, but he's a natural improviser, as
right.
most of the people coming up these days seems to be. They have improv training. I was straight Shakespeare theater. Read it on the page, and that's what you fucking say.
Yeah, no, they're all genius improvisers now.
Absolutely. So,
yeah.
So that's a learning curve for me to do that. So that's a good learning thing for me on this show, to do that more and more. We did it a little bit in news radio. You do it more and more in any show that you go on to.
Yeah.
That isn't strictly
right scripted
worded
tight.
And scripted tight.
But know? But you're doing it more on this show than you have ever.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And it's right. And,
yeah.
And good, because things change in the moment.
Yeah. And there's a naturalism that happens.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, and if you got the guy, you kind of like, that's what is always impressive. Like, because if you can lock into the guy and talk like the guy off script.
That's always the case anyway.
Right.
You know.
Yeah. Yeah.
But
yeah.
But doing the improv stuff has been a nice learning curve for me, and trying to relax while you do it, which is always the hardest thing. Just relax. Be the guy.
Yeah.
And then he'll say what he says.
Right.
Yeah.
Trust it, man.
Trust it.
So where did you come from? Because you're one of these guys, like, you know, there's not a lot of you around anymore. You know, these kind of like amazing character actors that you
I think there's a whole bunch of them. You just don't you don't see them as much in your head.
You always see them,
but you always see them,
right?
Because they're the guys in that make the show interesting that you're watching.
Yeah, I know. I guess maybe I'm romanticizing the 70s.
No, I hear you.
Because there was like four dudes that were in everything.
Absolutely.
You know, like, hey, there's Ned Beatty again.
Yeah, and Ned Beatty's one of my heroes.
Is he?
Sure. All those character guys were.
Yeah, like who else?
Oh my God.
Like, well, Ned was great, man.
Yeah.
Like, and then I guess Harry Dean was around.
Harry
a lot.
Dean was great.
You know, he was.
Yeah, he was unbelievable. He was in everything.
Yeah. So, but where did you come from?
I can't. I'm like an army brat, but not. My dad was construction. He built steam power plants for Basco.
And Basco.
Basco. And it was all over the Midwest. And it had taken a year and a half. Year and a half to build
to
one.
To build one?
And then, boop.
For the city? Is it like
he
was
city,
contracted by the city?
It's that little plant outside the city you see. And
with
every
the steam coming out.
Exactly.
You drive by on the highway and you're like, what the fuck is that smoke?
Uh-huh.
No, I think that's just steam.
And that's just me going to another place. So we'd be there a year and a half, 2 years, and we'd go somewhere else. So I was in... You know, we started out in Glen Rock, Wyoming, to Sioux City, Iowa, to Muncie, Indiana, to Fort Lauderdale, back to Kansas City, Wichita, all those places.
Where were you born?
I was born in Sarasota, literally there for 3 weeks. My parents, then he was transferred to New Orleans, where my brother was born. And then we were transferred to Monroe, and then we were transferred to Glen Rock, Wyoming.
Every year and a half?
Pretty much. Never more than a couple of years.
So you were the kid that, showed up in school?
I was the fat-ass kid who'd walk up, to write something on the chalkboard and wiggle his ass and be laughed at. So I was always the new kid.
Yeah, so you had you're the one who showed up in the middle of the year?
Yeah. I sit over there.
That's brutal.
It was brutal.
And your little brother have to go through that? How many are there of you guys?
There's just two of us. Uh-huh. But it wasn't brutal to us because it was normal. Until you got to junior high and high school, where I was 2 years in Kansas City and then was ripped out and taken down to Vero Beach, Florida.
Right when you had friends.
Right when I finally had some friends. And I was, a nice science fiction comic book nerd guy, had some friends.
Yeah.
Was on the track team.
Playing D&D? Was that around yet?
Didn't do that.
Oh.
I'd rather sit there and read Asimov.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then we'd get ripped and go to Florida. And it was like, I found myself cheering for, football team. I don't give a shit about this.
I can't get attached.
I just went home.
So you're always a sci-fi guy?
Yeah, I always was.
Yeah.
As my mom got me into it. She was a sci-fi, the big four, Clark and Asimov and Heinlein and Simic and all those guys.
Your mom was into it?
Yeah.
What'd she do?
She was a housewife,
yeah,
obviously, because she had to move all the time. But she had started art classes at Pratt, because she lived in Jersey when she was growing up. And she would have continued with that. I think she still did. She would go to the local paper wherever we would go and, say, I can do some layouts for you and draw some bras and whatever.
Yeah. And she'd do that?
Yeah.
So that was her dream?
I don't know if it was her dream, but she could have done that. Had she not gotten married and started moving.
I always wonder about that. My mom's is the same way. She was an art person.
Yeah.
Painter.
Yeah.
Like, I've been doing a bit on stage about that, how, how you don't really know your parents until, if they're lucky enough, they live long enough to get to know them as older people. Because when they're younger, you don't know them and they resent you because you ruin their life.
Well, ours wouldn't. Ours would take us to I remember in Kansas City, I was probably, I don't know, 13.
Yeah.
My brother was 11 or 9. They would drop us off at the museum all day.
Yeah.
They would just drop us off.
Sure.
And we would play chess outside on the big lions and just walk around as if,
Well, that was back when you could just leave kids.
You could just leave kids and they would wander around.
I like that framing of that, though. Like, my parents are like that, too. You should go to camp or you should spend a week over there. And it was really, it seemed like, proactive, but I think they want you out of the house.
Yeah, they just want to get rid of you. You find that out later when you want to do that to your children.
So where do you land it to when you graduate high school? Are you doing any acting at all?
Oh, God, no.
Nothing? Just reading
Never.
Comic books?
No, I'd work construction at my dad's plant to pay for college. So I ended up, University of Florida is where I went because, it was cheap back in 1970 and it was a state school.
And was the family there at that point?
They were still there. And then they, right after that, he finally got his first atomic plant in Hanford that he worked on.
Hanford, where's that?
Hanford, Washington, in the Tri-Cities area.
In Washington State?
Kennewick, Pasco, whatever. Yeah, in Washington State.
Like a nuclear power plant?
Nuclear power plant, yeah. And this is in the late 70s, early 80s.
Was that a thing where he's like I got to brush up on how to design one of these?
Well, he was a construction supervisor, so it was still construction stuff. But he had started out as a civil engineer. He's probably one of the last guys without a college degree that got that high.
Right.
Yeah.
So they split and you're in college.
So they're up in Washington. I'm in college doing I don't know what. So I signed up for journalism because I took, I was a photographer for the school paper. So I don't know what I'm doing.
You're a photography guy too?
I enjoyed it, yeah.
Darkroom stuff?
Darkroom stuff. I would develop my own color slides in college because I don't know why. But it interested
That's complicated.
Me then. Yeah, it was fun. But I did a lot of black and white in the old,
art stuff.
Yeah. So I did that and I said, maybe I'll go into that. I don't know. And then I took an elective just to get a couple of things. So I was a spear carrier in one of the main stage productions. And then all these student directors would go, can I use you for this scene? And I went, I don't want, okay.
And this is just an elective.
This is just an elective.
Right.
And then three directing scenes in, I went, I can do this. This is fun.
Yeah.
This is fun. And there's women. here in the department that will maybe go out with me.
A nerd's journey.
It was a nerd's journey into heaven. So then I got hooked up to the theater department, switch majors.
Like 2 years in?
Yeah.
So you did 2 years in the theater department. So you got an undergraduate acting degree?
Never. I got a job before that.
Oh, you didn't finish?
No. God, no. No. They had a... Hell no. I have an AA from the University of Florida. That's all I got.
What's that? That's the
first
honorary?
2 years. The first 2 years.
That's it?
The first 2 years. Uh-huh. That's all I got. Yeah.
Hasn't anyone given you a special one?
You'd think.
It's only a matter of time.
It is.
Yeah.
Yeah. If I make it into my 70s, I'll probably get
one. Grab that Emmy, you might get an honorary degree. You might
You're right there. I didn't think about that. But yeah, so then I changed majors, went into that. But I left because there's a big audition in the South called the SETCs. Southeastern Theater Conference audition.
Oh,
so
okay.
A lot of regional theater, a lot of... And the biggest one was the National Shakespeare Company out in New York, Bus and Truck. You'd go into the company, you'd put up 3 shows and tour the country with it.
Did you do any Shakespeare in college?
Yeah.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, I did.
So you took to it?
And I loved it.
Really? Yeah,
really loved it.
Huh.
And then, so I got that job. Went straight from college to New York, 3 weeks in Woodstock to rehearse 3 shows, onto a 1963 Trailways, and boom, for 9 months of the year, you're playing colleges and some bigger venues sometimes.
So as a Shakespearean actor, like, so when they look at you, I imagine they're thinking like, well, this guy's got a handle on the language of it, and they can move you around. I mean, you should be able to play most of the male parts.
Well, there's only 12 of us in the company, so we were triple cast in every show, unless you were Othello.
Right.
You know, you were always somebody. Audrey the Country Wench and Corin the Old Man, you know, in the same show. It was
so you
great.
Did it real old school? You wore wigs? You had to play women?
Oh, yeah, fake balloon tits, the whole thing. It was great. Yeah, I was 24, you know.
And so you're on the road,
yeah.
You know, and there's 12 in the.
But this is 76, so we're all, you know, hippy dippies with hair down to here that we had to curl up every night and put under wigs.
So you're 24 and 76.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. And so we were in the middle of the country doing Shakespeare. You know, we'd go to truck stops and we'd get out the thing and they go, Shakespeare, huh? You make emerald and reels? Is that what you do? It's like, no.
Is that a company that makes fishing?
Uh huh.
Yeah, we have to travel cross country, all of us in the company.
Oh, yeah.
We're delivering rods and reels.
Here's
now.
One for you. But yeah, it was great. It was the best training you could get because you'd play the same show in a 300-seat junior college or a 5,000-seat West Point.
Yeah.
And that was 2 different performances.
Right.
Yeah.
Now, that was your training. That was the hands-on.
That was the hands-on.
So who was the director? Was it one guy?
It was a couple. No, it was a couple of people out of New York that they'd get direct the shows. But Philip Meister was the head of the company.
Uh-huh.
And he lasted for a while.
And you learned what? Basic Shakespearean acting?
Iambic pentameter. And we had a couple of older actors in their 30s.
Right. Yeah.
Who had done, Shakespeare training. So we learned on the go.
So do you think it would seem to me, I'm just trying to put it together with some of the work you've done throughout your career, is that I imagine that's a pretty good education in sort of being small and being large and being broad.
It was.
Within Shakespeare, there's all of those. I mean, and, if you're wearing a wig and fake boobs.
Absolutely. But the first thing it helped me in, I think, was when I was a Klingon on The Next Generation. And they, you know, they stick these teeth, you know, they put the teeth in there and you got the nose on. So you had to speak distinctly, which I could do in Klingon ease.
Because of your Shakespearean
training. It was my training.
So how does it, so after you do that, you're 24. I mean, it seems like it took a while to start a career. So where do you go from there?
Oh, yeah, no, it's straight theater because then you come off the tour.
Yeah.
I came off and I did a couple of years on it, and then I took a half a year off and did a lot of cubicle work and temp work and all that shit. And then I went back.
In New York or where were you?
Oh,
you stayed in New York.
In New York, yeah, of course. And
where were you living?
50th Street, Hell's Kitchen in the 70s, though it still was kind of Hell's Kitchen.
Wow. So it was still like the Westies territory. Like
still, yeah, yeah. It's still, I can still remember looking out the window and seeing obviously a hooker thrown out of a cab. Tied with her hands tied.
Oh, wow.
Jesus, we ran down there and untied her, and you went, boy, I'll see ya.
Yeah.
Like, wow. Yeah,
scary.
Okay? Yeah, scary.
And Times Square was still, so it was the late 70s, it was a mess.
No, it was a mess, bad. You couldn't walk down 41st Street.
Really?
Yeah.
I just remember that all around Port Authority, it was just crazy, man.
It was.
And all those weird live sex shows and
all that stuff.
It was not as pretty as it was.
No, and it was pungent when you walked down to 42nd Street
in the
summer.
Right. When did it start turning around? I mean, it was still kind of like...
In the mid-80s, it started turning around.
So it was pretty beat up, right. Yeah.
Yeah. So then I was just doing, off Broadway.
Like what kind of stuff?
Just really bad shows down below 14th
You just
Street.
Go to auditions by directors who
whatever the rag was that in those days, and you'd get auditions that way. But I finally got one that turned into an off-Broadway show to get the equity card.
Right.
Which was a great show called Journey's End, an R.C. Sheriff World War One play. So we opened, of course, in the middle of the transit strike and then closed. But that was good because that got me some real regional jobs out of town in Atlanta and on the East Coast.
Well, New York in the late 70s. So were you doing work down there where the Worcester Group was or any of the weird stuff?
Yeah, in that place. Yeah, down below 14th Street, there's a million little theaters that they'd rent for nothing.
Yeah.
They'd pay you nothing. Literally, they'd pay you two tokens. Wanted to get down there and wanted to get back.
And what was that experience like? Did you find that it was helpful?
It was helpful.
Because you were forced to do some weird shit?
Well, I was forced to make, I think it was good training to make gold out of straw, because it wasn't great writing. But
right.
But there's some interesting and good performers that you could work to make this thing better, and you had to work hard.
Did you meet, were there guys that we know that you were, kind of come in contact with down there, or playwrights or actors or anybody? Because there were some people around.
There were, and maybe probably, but I couldn't
Spalding Gray or Defoe or any of those cats?
But I didn't work with them because they might have made... $60 a week.
Right. So
I made a token.
Right. So they were on the next level.
Exactly.
So when you do the thing that was off Broadway that got your equity card, mm-hmm. what does it look like when you, what do you mean you get, what do you got gigs in Atlanta and that kind of stuff? How's that work?
Regional theater.
Oh, okay.
Because what got me the equity card then gets you your first agent, your first manager, whatever, who then sends you out for the regional jobs on the East Coast. Westport and all those things.
So you'd do a couple months in the summer doing two shows?
Everyone
knew?
Usually 8 week, 9 week, 10 week productions. You rehearse a couple of weeks and do them for six weeks.
For subscription theaters, for
Correct.
Older people.
A lot of blue hairs, yeah.
And you're doing musicals?
I didn't do musicals, although I was cast in one. I didn't get to do it, but I did mostly some classic stuff, a lot of new stuff.
Yeah.
That the regionals would do. And that's what ended up getting me on Broadway, which we did a show called So Long on Lonely Street at the Alliance in Atlanta.
Right.
And that transferred to Boston, transferred to Broadway. So that was my first Broadway thing.
Yeah. And was it a lead?
It was the lead. Yeah.
Yeah.
It was the lead. It was great. Lasted for a month. That's pretty good.
That's not bad.
Not bad.
Good reviews.
Oh no, that's why it lasted a month. But it was great though. I mean, because going out of town and rehearsing out of town in Boston and having a big success there, and then coming into town and then going, this is a piece of shit from Atlanta.
Hey, is that what happened?
Yeah.
Well, that is true. I mean, I guess that's a good way to do it. I know that about stand-up. That,
well, it's the only way.
You pound it out, and then you show up.
Never expected to do film or TV. I mean, I thought I was going to be a regional theater actor. That's what I got into doing.
And you were okay with that?
I was okay with that. And then by the mid-80s, I'd been in New York long enough that and seen enough casting directors to go, do you want to audition for this movie or this TV thing? And I said, yeah.
Yeah, and so outside of the Shakespearean touring company, no training?
Other than what I had at Florida, which was minimal, really. The training that I got was on stage.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
I mean, because I talk to actors because I try to kind of suck a acting lesson out of you.
The only way that I learn is working with actors that are much better than I am, and I,
true,
and I
right?
fucking yeah, and you steal from them. That's as you do.
Yeah,
from everyone. You steal from the 30s character actors that you saw in movies that you love.
Their approach.
You steal from the 50s.
What are you stealing exactly?
By stealing, I mean their. You see their timing.
Yes,
and you see
right.
how good they are. And you absorb it as much as you can. I think I got half my timing from Warner Brothers cartoons because the timing in those things was so great.
Right.
You know, they whoosh, whoosh, mum.
Yeah.
And you got that. And,
yeah.
And by stealing, I mean just absorbing what you can learn from people that are really good.
Well, I noticed that like recently, just because I'm relatively new at it, is that there is a pace that you have to own when you're doing something. You know, it's really, and you decide it.
Mm-hmm.
Right, so the timing is everything. I imagine with Shakespeare too, like there is a, if you're nervous or you don't know where you're going with your character, you're probably going to rush and it's not going to land.
Exactly,
shit's got to land.
Which is why I have to have a really solid base. Usually, I'll go over and over and over lines so that then I know them so well that then I can play. Then I can go this way, go that way, go. Anyway,
so that's the way to do it
for me.
Yeah,
but that's not. A lot of people show up, and while they're in makeup, they look at their script and go, "What's today?"
Yeah,
I can't do that.
Right,
but it's how you do it for you.
Well, it's interesting, right? Because I imagine they kind of either they don't care, and they can. Pull
I'm hoping
it
off. That's not the truth,
and they can pull it off.
Yeah, because they either have a great memory or they're just more comfortable being
in the,
barely knowing it.
Right, it gets them in the moment, maybe.
It does.
Sort of a cheat.
And for me, being prepared gets me in the moment.
Right.
And then I can do whatever I want.
Right. So, okay, so you're doing all these series. Did you ever have any great successes on Broadway?
I guess so. We won the Tony for Best Revival of All My Sons back in 86.
I just saw that show with Tracy Letts.
Yeah, yeah. And we were lucky enough after winning the Tony that we had Arthur Miller come talk to us on the steps of
really?
the stage. You know, the ultimate theater experience.
And what year was that? That was
86 or 87.
So he's old.
Remember. Yeah, he's old.
And what did he have to say?
He liked it a lot because we had just a really good cast, and he liked it.
And who was the lead?
We had a couple of leads. Ralph Waite started it at the Long
Wharf. From the Waltons?
From the Waltons, yeah. Yeah.
He was the old man?
He was
the dad?
Yeah, he was the dad. And we had a couple of others, but Man of La Mancha, he starred in the film Man of La Mancha.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Him.
Not Jose
Ferrer. No.
What is that guy's name? Jeez. Yeah, that guy.
The him.
Yeah, yeah.
Which I was with every day, and I can't remember his name. I can't remember anybody's name anymore. It's astonishing.
Well, you know, when you have a life and you've lived a couple of different cities, and
holy moly.
It gets to a point where you're like, someone goes, you know, hey, Steven, and you're like, just give me a time frame and a city.
Yeah.
And tell me I didn't do anything terrible.
What I know is when people come up to me and say, Steve, I go, oh, that's somebody from 30 years ago. I've been Steve for a long time. Yeah.
What are you, Steven?
I've been Steven since I had...
Oh, really?
Yeah.
You made a choice?
I made a choice to be Steven.
So only people that knew you that long ago were Steve?
It's Steve, yeah.
So they
all think I'm fucking weird if I... Steven, that's not who you are.
We know you, Steve.
You're Rutt. You're Steve Rutt.
those guys are still around?
Oh, yeah. This is great.
Still friend with them?
Oh, yes, several.
So okay, so then you're kicking around. So when does the movie thing kick in?
It kicked in. I did my first movie.
Yeah.
I went in to read, and
yeah.
They liked me, and they said you're going to the callback, but don't you ever tell them that this is your first
right.
movie. So I didn't, but
yeah.
I got the job.
What was it?
Monkey Shines, George Romero.
Oh really?
Yeah.
I kind of remember that.
Yeah. Johnny Panko is in it. It's great.
Yeah.
But I
is it a scary movie?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's kind of a horror
yeah.
movie, you know, monkey licks your bleeding wounds movie.
Oh, wow.
But then I got into, Crocodile Dundee, the sequel,
yeah.
Crocodile Dundee 2.
Yeah.
And had a nice part in that, and then got into Ghost,
yeah,
which was a big movie.
Well, yeah,
so I'm thinking, oh, motherfucker,
you're in.
I'm into the big movies, and yeah. That was the last one.
That was
of course
it?
For a long time.
Was it?
Yeah, because then I started doing a lot of TV out in L.A. because I came out to L.A. in '90.
But it says, like, let's see, I'm just looking at some of the credits. Like, what were you in Stanley and Iris?
Yeah.
And what was that a good part?
Oh, it's great. I got to work with De Niro. It was fantastic.
Yeah, and did you learn anything from him?
That he was really generous. I mean, he had, I played, he had to put his father in a home. I played the head of the home.
Oh, yeah.
And then I have to tell him at some point in the picture that his father has died. And he does his crying, and he did his crying off screen for me.
Oh, really?
While I was doing my offstage line. So he was very generous.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, yeah. It was awesome.
And Ghost, and then like, oh, and then did you work? Did you have scenes with him in Guilty by Suspicion as well?
Yeah, just short.
Yeah,
short thing.
So these were a lot of them were those kind of parts.
Oh
where
yeah, you, yeah. Because
you had a few
you
lines.
You could do 5-10 Broadway plays, and then you go to L.A. and you're at the bottom of the rung.
Right.
Yeah, because they don't care what you do in Broadway.
But it seems like you were pretty good at, you know, at least making.
I was a good auditioner.
But you, like, even if you had like 4 lines, you know, you grounded yourself in it. You showed up for
showed
work.
Up
you know,
there.
And you're like that guy.
Because that was theater training. You're like, you ground yourself. You know your lines. You don't bump into the furniture and you're there.
And then you just started. And so when do you move to L.A. like permanent?
In 90.
Yeah.
In 90. And started immediately doing, you know, guest star stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Was that fun?
It was fun because the first thing I did, I think, was Night Court. I did a couple of things with Harry. Harry actually wrote me an episode and Roseanne and all that stuff then.
So, and that's a lot like theater, 3-camera.
Very much so.
You know, you're just a live audience.
Yeah.
And is that where you started to, you know, kind of really realize that, you know, in order to kind of really land it, you could kind of push the character a bit?
Yeah, because it's a strange hybrid doing 3-camera and an audience,
yeah,
or 4-camera and an audience, where you have to be small enough for the camera and big enough to,
right,
for a 200, you know,
get the laugh
seat audience. Yeah, so
yeah,
it was great learning experience. And
wow, you did Jake and the Fat Man
twice.
That was canon, right?
Yeah. Who never, ever, ever learned a line.
William Conrad.
Only huge cards behind your head that he read. Never looked at you. Only read his cards behind your head.
It was
and was great. He was great.
I remember when I was a kid because my parents used to watch Canon.
Yeah.
That was like a big show.
Was.
So was that one of those, like, I imagine as you get into, you know, working with these people that you've known, you know, as...
It's a
know,
cool thing
right,
for nerd boy to go
yeah.
work with these guys.
And
yeah.
then was that the first time you're like, oh, this is a different world. They're holding a giant sign behind me and you can really get away with stuff here.
Why doesn't he learn his lines?
That was the question?
Yeah, no, it's just, I mean, but that happens a lot. You know, sometimes they're just no time. You know, because they're on a 16-hour day and they
yeah.
have no time to do it. So
you're just kicking around, but you're making a living.
Yeah. Making a living.
But you're not necessarily noticed. No one's really.
No, I'd kind of, you know, I was like the stealth bomber. I'd come yeah. in and do stuff and that would be, you know, recognized
right.
as funny. And then
got
a chance to do it more and on news radio because I had 5 years of that.
And that was like you were a regular guy. You were on every episode.
Yeah.
You were like the owner?
I was the owner.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So you're working with Andy and Joe and
Phil Hartman.
Phil.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
The best and Joe Rogan and
yeah.
Vicki Lewis, Maura Tierney. I mean, it was an unbelievable
yeah.
cast. That I still love them all very much.
So that was when you're already like you're almost 40?
Oh, I'm 42. 43, something like that.
And that was the one that, you know, got you your insurance.
Yeah, yeah, all that stuff.
You know.
It's like an At that point, I was hoping to be Ed Asner.
Yeah.
You know, because Ed got that his Mary Tyler Moore job right about the same time.
42, right.
43.
Yeah.
He was about out of the business.
Right.
And he got that, and then blah, blah, and then it's Ed Asner.
Well, were you thinking that at the time? Because I know that I have thought that. Like, you're
when I heard that story, I thought of that.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, you, the guys you compare yourself to keep getting older in terms of when they broke.
Absolutely. Yes.
It eventually ends up like, well, Dangerfield.
I'll be able to do it someday. Yeah.
And so News Radio, then you landed and you were there for like 100?
100 shows, yeah. And then Phil, of course, unfortunately got killed. And we did another season with Lovitz as Phil's replacement, yeah.
I interviewed Phil not here, obviously, but in another format, in a weird sort of, it was like a streaming show, but mm-hmm. it was almost like before the internet could do it.
Right.
So no one saw it or heard it unless you worked at the Microsoft
Purpose.
Yeah. But I did get to meet him, and he's a very gracious, nice guy.
Really was.
And I recently acquired the America album that he did the cover art for.
He did. He did a lot of cut. He did Poco. Yeah. He did a whole bunch of stuff.
Yeah, that was his thing.
Yeah.
But I imagine working with a guy like that, you must have picked up some things.
Absolutely.
Because like he's another guy that can drop into characters, and he has that amazing timing that also seems founded in Warner Brothers.
It is, but also he was a very meticulous guy. He was the guy that had tabs on every scene in his script, knew exactly where he was at all times. Scene number 7, yep, boom, there. And he was very, very prepared.
So he's a guy that like didn't carry sides. He had a book script.
Yeah.
I'm noticing that more.
Yep.
I think that's one of the trickiest things about acting is like if you shoot out a sequence, like would it happen right before this?
Yeah, that's part of your homework, just to really find out where you are in the script.
I just shot
an indie where we did the last scene first.
Yeah.
And it was like, well, I don't have a character yet. Here we go.
Yeah. The end of the movie.
Yeah. End of the movie. I want you to figure out that character right now.
Backloaded.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's weird because, like, if you're not careful, you just sort of have the same energy in every scene. It's like, how come this guy's not tired? Didn't he just run here?
Yeah, so that's what I learned mainly in the first years in television, when you had to know exactly where you were in the script.
Do you have a whole book for yourself?
A couple of them old. I used to keep a lot of stuff, and then my wife finally said, no.
Oh, yeah.
You're not keeping that anymore.
But in terms of when you're on set, do you deal with sides, or do you have a note, like, the whole script with you?
I like to deal with I like to hold sides during camera blocking,
right?
And then I have to throw them because
sure.
then it's my life draft is gone and you have to work,
right?
Yeah.
So after News Radio, what now? When does a relationship with the Coens happens later? So how does Office Space? I mean, because that seems
well, that's King of the Hill, because right at the same time I was doing News Radio, King of the Hill, they asked me to audition for that,
right?
Mike did, because he knew I did a lot of Southern characters and I had done a lot of Southern theater characters. He
said,
come in for this.
Yeah.
So got on that. And then from that, he started writing Office Space. And we were all on the Fox lot doing King of the Hill. So he picked a bunch of us King of the Hill guys to read it for Fox.
Oh, you did table read.
We did a table read for Fox. And Mike was going to read Milton, the part that I did. And he said, nah, I just want to see it. You read it.
Yeah.
And, oh, thanks for the prep as we're walking over.
Yeah.
And he gives me this 2 minutes pencil sketch that he'd done of Milton. And he said, do that guy, kind of. And I said, okay. I said, I probably would give him more of a lisp and haltingness. And he said, whatever you do.
Yeah.
Have fun. But I did three or four characters that day. I did the psychiatrist or the hypnotist who dies in the middle of.
Oh, yeah, yeah. What's that guy's name who played him, the big guy?
Oh, he's great.
He used to be on Who's Line?
Yeah.
Great improviser.
Yeah.
Really liked that guy.
Tremendous.
I can't remember.
So I did his part. I did one of the Bobs. I did something else. So I did like three or four parts during that reading.
And they bought it. And then it becomes like initially.
Nothing.
Did our nothing. Zero.
Yeah.
Really.
Yeah. Zero. But it was right at the time, around 2099, 2000, when DVDs were becoming the huge thing.
Right.
So you go to Blockbuster and they recommend stuff and it became a word of mouth movie. And then people started coming up to you on the street saying your line. You go, nobody saw that movie. How did that happen? And it's DVDs.
And it was huge. I just was at the, I just was in Austin.
Yeah.
I was at South by Southwest, and then I was asked to present at some weird event where it was the anniversary of Office Space. Mm-hmm. What is it, like
20 years?
Yeah. And a couple of the guys were there, and Mike was there.
Yeah. I was going to be there, but I was working. Couldn't go.
Yeah. And so that guy, that character, you just put that together? Because that's the first time I remember, like, I remember seeing you, but that was such a transformation thing.
Yeah, but that's what I'd always been doing, but it got seen on a bigger scale.
Right.
You know, for that.
And, yeah.
It was just something that was real natural for me to do. Well, you Fontaine de la Tour d'Autrive. I love that guy. Just, I knew him. I knew guys like him. And I could do him.
So when you do that, I mean, so you knew guys like him. So do you find yourself, you know, like seeing people and are you a good mimic?
No, I'm a fairly decent audio mimic.
Yeah.
But I think all my life I've always felt like I was observing. You know, I think a lot of shy, quiet guys are observers.
And also, do you feel like that? And this is a weird question, but I just ask it from my own point of view. Did you feel like that you didn't have a complete self?
Yeah, I did, and then maybe that was because we moved. And
yeah,
I had no chance to complete myself.
Right.
Until I got to college,
and that creates a sensitivity.
Yeah, and because you're always looking, what is, should I be doing that? I don't know.
That's true.
And that
guy seems to be, he's able to talk to people and like people like him. Maybe I should, even if it's a haircut or a movement or a shoe.
Sure.
Yeah.
And that's where you get a lot of stuff. It's where you get Milton from Office Space because he doesn't understand. Look, I don't know. You know?
It's amazing that he's right there.
He's there whenever you need him. But people can do him really much better than I can now.
Oh, really?
20 years later. Yeah, they come up to me and they're much better at it than I am now.
So does that function as some sort of break for you in film? Or, you know, I mean, after the DVD thing, or no? I mean,
not really. It's just...
You're just kind of plugging along still?
Plugging along.
But news radio's huge.
News
so
radio
you,
was...
You're good.
Was nice.
Got a house. You got...
Settled.
Security.
Settled.
Yeah.
And,
right.
And some residuals and some okay.
Yeah.
And then you go get some more jobs.
Right.
But I found that I was getting offers and auditions for only sitcoms. So after a while, I just kind of stopped doing them.
Yeah.
And waited for some more. It's like, guys, I started in Shakespeare. I can do other stuff.
So you were concerned that you would be stuck there?
Yeah, I thought I'd be pigeonholed. So I wanted to educate some of the casting directors around town. So I ended up, which was good, I ended up getting... You know, smaller parts in dramatic shows until I finally got a nice recurring on West Wing, and then okay, all right,
oh, yeah.
You can do that. That's
right.
Fine. And then that leads to other things, and then they see you not as just
right.
Mr. Comedy.
When does the relationship with the Coens happen?
It happened around the same time as I think it was around 2000.
Yeah.
Around the same time as right after Office Space. I'm sure that they didn't know of Office Space because I went into their audition as a straight audition.
Yeah.
You know, working character actor.
Right. They love working character actors.
Yeah. So I went in and I we're what, 3 feet apart?
Yeah.
And I went in and they said, so you want to do this guy? And I went, yeah.
The two of them and
the
casting director?
Yeah, the two of them and the casting director. And I took off my glasses and I did the
and dropped your eye?
Yeah, dropped my eye.
Yeah.
And then I started doing the guy. And they just both went like that, which was great. It was my finest hour ever as an actor. And then and they gave me the role, which was very nice.
So you read the sides and you had the guy when you went in?
Yeah, I knew the guy.
Yeah.
I knew the guy.
And had you met that guy, that blind guy?
I'd heard that guy millions of times in
growing
the South.
Growing up in the South, yeah.
And I'd seen him he's an amalgamation of a couple of 30s things that I saw, yeah.
And I thought that was an amazing character. And that's one of those
love
ones where,
character.
You know, after you see Office Space and then you go see, you know, Brother, you're like, that's that fucking guy.
That's that guy, that weird guy.
Well, he can do all these things. but the thing is that as it seems that how the Coens use character actors and with the potential for cartooniness, you know.
It's always there.
Right, but they have a real handle on it.
They're so set.
Well, yeah, because like they did it with Nicolas Cage in Raising Arizona. They're like, you're a cartoon.
Yeah.
And that's that.
Yeah.
But then they kind of are able to ride this interesting line that is uniquely theirs, I think.
Yeah, they're storyboarded to within an inch of their lives.
That's what I
heard.
Every
movie, and it's a beautiful thing because then you do that and they're happy and then you play with one, and they might use some of that, might not.
Oh, okay.
But
so
it's very structured and
meticulous.
Easy to work with, yeah.
And they're good guys? Or,
oh, they're great guys.
But they seem like the kind of guys, like once they cast, you know, somebody who's, you know, I imagine that a lot of the actors they work with are as dug in as you and their character actors. And
yeah.
So they're sort of like, you know, we hired you to do the job. But
yeah.
You know, there's not a lot of notes
just
there.
Do what you do. Right. We'll tell you if you go way the hell off, but... Yeah,
because I found that kind of amazing in the part that you had in Buster Scruggs was that you didn't work with those three dudes, but you know you did the thing with Franco. But when Franco was, yeah. You know, in when those three guys ride up,
right?
They're all such old timey character actors. They just ate Franco for lunch.
Yeah,
it was amazing. It was like you don't even know Franco's there. Yeah. Oh yeah, he's got the noose around his neck. But what are those guys?
Those guys, because you're looking at him. Well, that's true. And all the great, you know, 30s, 40s movies, you're looking at the character. You're looking at Frank Morgan and
that's true.
Doing five characters in Wizard of Oz. You know, unbelievable people
forever in your mind.
Yeah,
those guys.
Yeah.
And you did another one with them, right? Or two more?
A couple more. I did,
yeah, No Country.
No Country, which was just great because I got to work with Woody.
Oh, that's right. You get shot up.
In the face.
Yeah,
yes,
yeah.
Lovely.
Yeah. Woody's so good in that. Everyone's so fucking good in that.
Oh, my God.
Roland, that was such crazy.
A scary movie in terms of, there's no music in that movie. There's no soundtrack. There's just sounds.
Yeah.
You know, squeaking sounds.
I don't know if I noticed that.
Oh, my God. Next time you watch.
Not a soundtrack. And Scruggs, so you did three or four?
I also did Lady Killers.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Which is with Tom Hanks. And he was fantastic in it.
How does he, like, that's right, he played this sort of southern kind of dandy-ish.
Yeah, they're bank robbery type of thing.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
How was he to work with? Was that like a big moment?
It was big for me because he cast me in From the Earth to the Moon before that. From the Earth to the Moon, the HBO thing.
Yeah, yeah.
And I got to play Chris Kraft, head of flight. Operations at NASA, yeah.
Oh, the guy that just passed.
Yeah, he just passed. But I played him through the whole series, and so Tom had
he hired me for that. And like, you seem to like do a lot of these crazy comedies.
Mm-hmm.
But Idiocracy. I think that movie was genius.
It's way ahead of its time. It's what's happening right now.
Sure, I mean, as a satire, it was very prescient.
Yeah,
but I don't know why the movie didn't take off like Office Space and develop a cult.
Don't know whether that's Fox's problem with promotion or what.
I feel like if it could have had a couple more million dollars,
it
would have been different.
Yeah, and maybe I don't know, maybe a bigger star. But I mean, I thought everybody was great in that.
Oh, Dax Shepard's
fantastic, and that was his first huge role. It was
Baiting.
Great. I'm baiting.
I like the slang of it. Like, it's just what we all do.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, you're in Get Out. Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
You were the photographer with no eyes, right?
Of course. That's my guy. That likes to get his scalp cut off. Yes, lovely. I'll do that.
And how do you, like, when, so you get sent stuff all the fucking time.
Yep. Yeah, and Barry, I mean, I'm thrown all over the place in that. Very physical.
But I mean, you got to turn a lot of stuff down, right?
Yeah. At this point, I'm really working for script and people. You know, really good scripts and to work with really good people so I can learn from them.
But what about directors? I mean, like, it's hard for me to, like, you know, wrap my brain around as many movies you've done. But, like, you know, have there been directors?
Well, I wanted to work with Clint Eastwood, so I got to do that.
J. Edgar,
J. Edgar, which was amazing. Really fun. And everything that people said it would be.
He shoots real quick, right?
Shoots real quick. And I had people who had worked on other movies who was saying, just learn everything in a row because you might do it once.
Oh, really?
You might. And even the first was saying when we were shooting something, he said, yeah, we'll go up to this point and then we'll stop. And said, no. Just right all through it. And he used that and that was it.
And was he a nice guy?
Super nice. Super nice.
What other directors have made an impact?
I really liked working with Redford. To watch him,
watch
him work was phenomenal.
Yeah? Like, because I can't, like, he's one of those guys that's sort of like, those guys who are real movie stars.
Yeah.
And then they, you know, have to find a range within that. Mm-hmm. It's sort of it's not
the pretty.
An easy
he's
trick.
The prettiest character actor around. I'll tell
yeah.
you that.
Yeah, and but he really can drop into things.
Yeah, he's fantastic.
Like Brad Pitt's sort of the same way.
Yeah,
like,
I feel the same way.
Have you worked with that guy?
No, I know Brad from
stuff,
but I haven't worked with him. We talked about the tank movie that he did.
Oh yeah,
that was basically my father's tank in World War II.
Oh really?
Yeah, his tank was the third tank across the Remagen in the Battle of the Bulge, and that was
your dad's was
yeah. Yeah.
So he was like that guy, that generation, that
yeah.
guy had
yeah.
the, did he have stories? A lot of those guys didn't talk much about the war.
Oh, he never talked about it.
Isn't
unless
that
weird? He had five drinks in him, he would never say anything about it. So we only got a couple of stories from him.
Why do you think that is?
Who wants to remember starving, drinking potato vodka in the middle of Germany in 1945? You know,
yeah.
What are you going to do?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like, it's almost like, yeah, that's, I guess that was that generation's approach to PTSD. You just
yeah.
don't do it.
Don't. Yeah. And I don't want to think about it.
Right.
I remember my mom going to, she would always go to photo exhibits, and we went to one that had Depression era. And she went, I lived through that. I don't want to see that.
Oh my God!
Yep.
Did he? Did he have? Did he win medals? Did he get? For
yeah, real? Yeah, yeah. He did.
I can't imagine. I don't know. I don't have any direct experience. With
well,
people.
The most interesting thing about him was that he didn't start there. He enlisted in 39
uh-huh.
in the cavalry because there was still a cavalry.
Horses.
Horses. Trained his own horse.
Uh huh.
And they disbanded it in 40, 41, I think, yeah.
And he was a tank commander?
And they threw him into a tank, which he hated so much.
I can't even fucking imagine.
I can't even.
Have you done any war movies? Where you had to, like, get into that zone?
No, I always wanted to. Never got a chance to.
Yeah, because, like, I just, like, if you really think about it empathetically, you know, what some of those guys have gone through,
mm-hmm.
you know, in these machines that...
Oh, my God.
I can't fucking imagine it. So yeah. What did you talk to Pitt about?
Well, about, I just said, how did you feel in there? He said, yeah. I stayed in there all day. I loved it in there.
Oh, really?
He said, I would eat lunch in there. But he just wanted to absorb the whole thing because he's a really smart guy. And
he's a great actor.
And he immerses himself in whatever he's doing. So he knows all about it.
But he's sort of surprising with the kind of, like, in that one Coen Brothers where the Burn After Reading, that character was insanely funny
mm-hmm.
that he played.
Oh, yeah.
And did you see the new Tarantino?
It's this week. My wife and I are going this week.
And have you worked with him?
Tarantino, no. No.
Would you like to?
Oh, sure. Why not?
Yeah.
That'd be great.
Yeah. Who are the big hopes? The Scorsese?
I don't really have a hope because it's all, for me, it's all script driven.
Yeah.
You know, if you're a great director and you're doing a shitty script, I don't want to do it.
I had Erwin Winkler in here.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I liked that movie, that Guilty yeah. by Suspicion.
Oh, yeah. I thought it was a good movie.
And you did the other Blacklist movie too, huh? Trumbo? Did you
Trumbo, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah, Jay Roach. He's great.
Yeah.
I just did his Roger Ailes movie. That is not out yet.
Oh, that's right. I talked to somebody else who was in that. How's it feel?
That was great. Really fun.
Is it gonna deliver a punch?
I hope so. I'm gonna.
Is it a comedic slant or is it straight up?
No, it's a straight up, and I'm hoping to see it fairly soon. I'm also seeing another movie I did, Seberg,
with who?
Jean Seberg, with Kristen.
Yeah.
Playing her, and that was a really nice experience.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And now, okay, so are you excited about the Emmy possibly, the nomination?
You know, the most fun you can have is the first 2 days when people you haven't heard from for a while say, you got an Emmy nom,
yeah.
That's fantastic. But just the nom is the thing for me. The nomination yeah. is the win.
And yeah, you've gotten before?
Oh, never.
This is it.
Never.
No.
Far away from it as possible. But so that was fun for the first 2 days. And now it's, you know, we're doing this to promote it. And, you know, but it's great.
Yeah.
And as Hader says, you know, it's that maybe we'll get another season out of it. That's the best thing that could happen.
That's right.
Yeah.
And what do you do for, like, have you kept any of those hobbies? Do you still shoot pictures? What's your thing that you do for fun? You got a boat?
Like you do.
Yeah.
I do a lot of album stuff. I love
I like that.
Album
do you go
stuff.
Out and buy them and stuff?
I go out and buy them. I don't do the internet thing because
no.
I like to feel the product.
Do you go out to, do you go to the guys in Highland Park over here that I go to?
Yeah,
Gimme Records?
Yeah, I haven't been there for a while.
Yeah.
I whenever I go... I'm shooting travel, somewhere. Like yeah. I went to North Carolina, I shot something, and da da da. I go to the local record stores there and hunt, and yeah. it's fun.
It is fun. Have you been to Indiana? There's a couple places. The problem with the fucking record stores a lot of times is that because of the internet, they all know what they have.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
You know, you have to be in an area where you have to find albums that are important to you that sure. might not be collectible albums. It's not that I'm looking for deals, but it is kind of fun
no,
to find
a thing.
No, but
you're not going to find a Butcher cover, you know.
No, of course
in
not.
In Tennessee for $5.
No, not unless you find it in a garage somewhere.
Exactly.
But there's a good one in Indiana called Landlock Records in Bloomington.
Okay.
And they've got the racks on top, but then underneath there's just hundreds.
Yeah.
And the records, like, you know, I'll buy a Skynyrd record, you know, like right. records that I like, but nobody gives a fuck about.
Yeah. Or you know, the Motors from about 80, 81. Anyway.
Good.
You know, so stuff like that.
That means
something
to you.
That means something to you.
Yeah.
That when you were in New York and you bought their 45 that came out and you went, oh, I want to have that album.
Yeah. Who are your big bands? Do you love the Beatles?
Yeah. I've always been a huge Beatle fan, yeah. but all the whole British Invasion thing. Oh, the Who, the Kinks are
Kinks
probably
are great.
Oh my God, they're my favorite.
I just picked up that Muswell Hillbillies.
Oh, what a great album.
Oh, it's great.
Great album.
You can find those around.
Yep.
Probably 20, 30
yeah,
bucks.
Yeah, I still got my original.
You do?
Yes, sir.
Well, it was great talking to you, man.
Thanks, man. It was really fun.
And I hope I hope you win it. That'd be exciting.
That would be nice. But, you know, Anthony Carrigan, brilliant. Henry, brilliant. I don't care.
Yeah.
Doesn't matter. And Tony Shalhoub is one of my heroes, and
yeah,
so
I've talked to him. He's great.
Yeah, and Alan.
Is that who the other guys are?
Yeah, they're wow. like legends. So I don't hold any great hopes, but I was happy to be included.
Did you own your own tux?
I do own my own tux.
That's good.
I've got a nice tux that I can wear. I don't know.
Yeah, well,
we'll
that's
see.
Nice. Maybe, you know, it'd be nice to get that up on stage.
Well, I mean, this is the greatest thing is that your wife gets a new dress. So there it is.
A new dress. And, you know, I did have the experience of, you know, going to one of these award shows because by some fluke I was nominated for a SAG award.
Awesome.
But it's nice to go to those things and see everybody.
It is. It's so pleasant.
It's like, you know, this is your community.
Yeah.
And you never see everybody.
Never see anybody.
And then you can be like, hey.
Yeah, it was great.
Well, have fun, man.
Thanks, man. You too.
That was me and Stephen Root. Nice guy. Glad I got to talk to him about some things. I love that guy's work. He's nominated for an Emmy for Outstanding Supporting Actor in a Comedy Series for his role in HBO's Barry. And now, some guitar. I swear I'm gonna string up my Strat and I'm gonna clean it up. I'm just not there yet. Boomer lives.